tea.
Sheffield Live. Made in Sheffield. Made by you.
If you like rock in all its forms, you will love Glory Days. You can listen to us locally on 93.2 FM and on the telly, and anywhere in the world on sheffieldlive.org. What do you think, Don? You know what? I think he likes it. That's Glory Days, every Monday 1 till 3 here on Sheffield Live. Bosh, bosh. Oops, I've had an accident.
Hello, I'm Harry Wilburn. I present Steel & Wire every Wednesday, 10 a.m. Americana, bluegrass, American roots, and more. Lots more. Lots of guests, lots of local music and musicians. That's Steel & Wire, Wednesday, 10 a.m.
You are listening to fabulous Harry Wilburn on Steel & Wire.
It's time to open the music box. Join me, Steve Roden, every Thursday morning between 10 and 12 for music from the 40s to the 90s from my own music collection. Songs I've grown up with, ones I am sure you will enjoy hearing again. Hope to see you then.
If you love new music and you want to discover the best new artists out there, then tune into The Backroom with me, Paddy. I'll be playing the best of new indie, electro, EDM and punk and showcasing new Sheffield talent. Also music news, local and national gig guide and new album releases. So tune into The Backroom every Thursday night between 6 and 7pm here on Sheffield Live, 93.2 FM.
This is Sheffield Live.
My name is Fruitland, your check is in the mail, Jackson, and you're listening to Sheffield Live 93.2 FM.
Good morning. Welcome to the Life Science Radio Show here on Sheffield Live 93.2 FM on digital if you're in South Yorkshire or sheffieldlive.org. You can listen online there. You can also download the podcasts, even save them should you wish and listen at your leisure. This show's all about science in all its different forms. You've got Julian Paul here live on Saturday the 19th of October 2024, just in case you're listening on catch-up. The introduction, you had a bit of a spurious Fruitland Jackson in there. That was my fault. It was a bit of a strange ending to the
because
show before.
We were 10 seconds
short. We were, but that's it with live radio. Anyway, later in the show, we'll be talking to RPG, of course, as always, another member of the Life Science team here at Sheffield Live. This Saturday, because our Gareth Morgan is away, he's Sheffield Photographic Society, of course, he's away, so we've mixed things around a bit. We've got Chris Dale back on. He's going to be talking about food allergies. We might also be talking a little bit about the junk food ban and a few other things, who knows. Next Saturday, fingers crossed, we've got another change to the schedule. We should have Paddy Vessey with us. He's a fellow presenter here at Sheffield Live. He does The Backroom, a new music show on Thursdays, 6 till 7. He'll be coming to talk about his day job. He'll be covering mental health, all good stuff. First up, we're just going to mention again about the Sheffield Photographic Society's exhibition.
Yeah, that is free, and that is at the Sheffield Winter Garden from 12 noon on Friday, the 1st of November, until 3 p.m. on Sunday, 10th of November.
It's all good stuff. Spread the word,
and
as we
nice
said.
It's nice and warm in there.
It's lovely, and you see a great range of photography as well. All good stuff. Before we go on any further, there was a bit of good news I picked up. Bit of good news. We all like that, don't we?
Well, if you're a kid.
It's an interesting one. Well, no, it's not just for kids, though, is it?
No, you wouldn't believe this. Anyway, good news. Lego has announced plans to make its bricks entirely from renewable or recycled plastic by 2032. The Danish toy maker already gets 22% of its plastics from sustainable sources. up from 12% in 2023. It aims to hit the 50% mark by 2026. Last year, the company scrapped efforts to make its bricks from recycled water bottles. But thanks to increased profits, it is now invested in pricier but more eco-friendly alternatives.
You see, more profits. It's not just kids who do Lego, you know. So there you go. But you're, of course, listening to the Life Science Radio Show here on Sheffield Live 93.2 FM. We're every week talking about science in all its different forms. This is a cracking story. I thought it's very timely as well because next weekend the clocks fall back by 1 hour. Yes, it really is that time of year. I saw this article. It's about a book. It's called The Inner Clock, Living in Sync with Our Circadian Rhythms. And it's written by a woman called Lynn Peoples, spelled P-E-E-P-L-E-S.
Yes.
So here we go. It's just a great story. From wherever it is that you're listening to this, how many clocks are in sight? Are you wearing a watch? Is there a ticking face on the wall? Does the glowing digital display on your oven or microwave unwittingly tell you the time? Interesting.
Julie, there's so many clocks
there
here.
There is in here, in at a live radio studio, and let's hope they're working correctly. Yeah, I know, but you don't think about it, do you? This book called The Inner Clock points out that the ubiquity of man-made clocks is easy to forget. Now, ubiquity means, because it appears everywhere and is very common, you sort of forget how common it is or prevalent it is. So this book says it's easy to forget until you want to avoid looking at them. So the Inner Clock book begins with its author, and she's a science journalist, as I said, called Lynn Peoples, trapping herself in a decommissioned, although luxuriously refurbished, underground nuclear missile complex in Arkansas. For 10 days, she makes an effort to live according to her body's natural rhythm. Completely time-blind, as she said, she avoided clocks and sunlight while keeping close tabs on changes in her mood, hunger, alertness, coordination and cognition. So after 5 sleep periods, now the author, Lynn Peoples, avoids categorising her time in that bunker into days and nights. She says after 5 sleep periods, she begins to feel woozy and weak. After 8 sleep periods, she's basically nocturnal, whipping up a stack of pancakes for a dinner at 6 a.m. in the morning. Now, released back into the outside world, the author Lynn Peoples is slow to readjust to her life on a normal schedule. Her experiment proved what almost all of us already assume to be true, that environmental cues are quite important to us. So Aristotle noted that bees consistently sleep through the night. Another guy, a French astronomer called, I'll try and pronounce this correctly, Jean-Jacques de Hautes de Maran, French astronomer, put a plant in a shady cupboard and observed that its fern-like leaves still furled and unfurled on a 24-hour schedule. Left to our own devices, our bodies are unlikely to measure a day as 24 hours long. Early risers can have a cycle as low as 23.5 hours, while that of an evening person might stretch up to 24.5 hours. But on average, though, the endogenous human cycle adds 9 minutes to the sun's allocation. I had to look that word up as well. Endogenous, I think I've said that right. It's our internal 24-hour biological clock in our brain that regulates cycles of alertness and sleepiness according to light levels. So, but adapting to this isn't as simple as setting your morning alarm 9 minutes later, because sleep duration, sleep timing aren't the same thing. The author insists that we should tailor our rest schedule to the hours our body is inclined to doze. And she says, remarkably, 7 hours of sleep timed correctly can make us feel healthier and better rested than 8 hours timed wrongly. It's also worth paying attention to our body's prime times and worst times. The worst time, which is our deepest circadian trough, falls between 2 a.m. and 5 a.m. in the morning. And she says, this is really interesting, name any disaster involving a human error and chances are that it happened in or around these unsociable hours. She talks about Chernobyl, Three Mile Island and the Union Carbide chemical plant explosion in India all followed the pattern. On the other hand, scheduling important events in prime hours of your circadian rhythm could be the key to getting a job interview, a successful job interview, conceiving a baby, or even getting a personal best in a 10-kilometre run, thinking of Phil Muffet there. Certain studies suggest that adjusting the time chemotherapy is administered may bolster its ability to attack some tumours. Now, scientists have proved that tissues and organs run according to their own circadian rhythms, most of which tick along in harmony, directing the proteins that do the work to keep your body moving along. Even hair follicles have rhythm, which is why beards grow fastest during the day. A 5 o'clock shadow won't appear overnight if a man shaves before bedtime. Get that, eh? The reason jet lag makes you feel foul is because these cellular clocks fall out of sync. So what else interrupts our circadian systems? Contrived time zones, cigarette smoke, midnight microwave meals and other modern insults brilliantly described by the author. Each uniquely human. Some experts refer to a Netflix effect. Exposure to artificial late light at night tricks the body into thinking it's earlier than it is and makes it harder to fall asleep. The digital age has nudged us all towards the owl end of the night. Owl, morning lark spectrum. In the pre-industrial era, the author Lynn Peoples emphasises the midpoint of a good night's sleep was close to midnight in the pre-industrial era. Now the average midpoint of a good night's sleep is about 4 a.m. So how do we reset our broken clocks? The author wisely recommends we pay close attention to what our body tries to tell us on days when we don't have a place to be. When do your eyes first open? What time do you begin to feel tired? When the 23rd hour strikes, is your body prepping for sleep or is it revving to go for another hour or two? Once you've gathered the facts, adjust your work-life schedule, if possible, to match your natural patterns 7 days a week. And if you're looking for smaller, non-committal fixes, she has a few of those up her sleeve as well. She says, sit closer to windows, opt for warmer coloured light bulbs, take a 20-minute nap early in the afternoon, try and eat meals closer together so that an entire day's worth of eating happens within 10 hours. Do your best not to bite into popular myths that you can fix your personal circadian hygiene simply by taking a melatonin supplement, wearing fashionable blue light glasses and having one espresso shot in your coffee instead of two. Now, the author Lynn Peoples, she once crunched numbers as a biostatistician and it shows. This book called The Inner Clock is crammed full of facts and figures and fascinating scientific studies. The Inner Clock is a book that she does really well. Are we all going to stop setting our alarm clocks and start rocking up hours late to work? Probably not, but there's no doubt that it would help us all to be more aware of how we can make our bodies work best.
Look at your watch. What a time. Look at your watch. But I represent eternity, the law of this world, and the other. Look at your watch.
What a great track. Pity the recording's not better. That's Clock Conscious by Orchestra Arcana from 1986, also known as Bill Nelson under another name. If you've just tuned in, of course, you're listening to the Live Science Radio Show here on Sheffield Live 93.2 FM on digital if you're in South Yorkshire or sheffieldlive.org. Talking about science in all its different forms, we should have RPG on the line. Morning, PG.
Good morning.
Good morning on this rather, well, miserable morning, to be fair.
It's getting better.
Yeah, well, it's that time of year, isn't it?
I'm afraid it is.
Yeah.
So well, what's caught...
Interesting.
Yeah, go on. What's caught your eye in the science news this week, then?
Well, something that kind of parallels with what you've just been talking about, the circadian rhythms and things. I thought, well, it's that time of year, and 22nd, I think, of September, we entered autumn. In 2024, and that'll carry us through until the 30th of November, when it'll change to winter.
Ooh.
And looking around me and recent windy days, I started to think about the falling leaves. And I thought, well, what actually starts the trees? How do they know? When should they start falling
leaves? It is interesting, because each year it's different.
Come on, Paul, tell us.
Yeah. It's incredible. Well, leaf drop is known as abscission, and it starts when there's a layer of cells that are formed where leaf stalks join the stem. And it's formed in spring with the new growth of the leaf. And in autumn, hormones within the trees begin to change. And the most notable one of those is auxin. And basically, they get together and cause the leaf to break off at the stem where it grew from. And I thought, well, okay, so, yeah, I can see that kind of mechanism working. But realistically then, why? Why would trees sort of develop in that way? I said evergreen plants in cold climates usually have thick waxes and resins that protect the leaves from freezing or fracturing, whereas deciduous trees, the ones where the leaves fall, have thin leaves that are susceptible to cold temperatures, and because as water freezes, it expands, the leaf cells are then damaged in winter, so they can't complete the photosynthesis role that they take on, which is creating effectively the food for trees. And without dropping the leaves, the tree is going to be stuck with all these dead leaves and no way to make food. And if that's not the sort of main driver, the other thing is that winter months are often windier and often with broad leaves on trees, brittle trees, because they're drying out because they're not being fed, could cause major breakages. And also the same goes for snow. If snow collects on trees that are in full leaf, they can really sort of get damaged. So, and really by the end of summer, a lot of leaves have I mean, if you've been out in your garden this year, have been insect-eaten or diseased or damaged, so effectively dropping them off gives the plant a fresh start for the spring, and the nutrients from decaying leaves are recycled to help grow the next leafy generation.
Yeah, leaf mould. I've picked up quite a lot of stories about leaf mould and collecting water and stuff, but leaf mould's a good thing to do. You know, it's good for your garden. If you get it off your lawn, if you've got a lawn, of course,
yep,
drive you mad, but leaves will get taken back into the soil, won't it?
Yes, it does. It helps to contribute to the tree's well-being long-term. And I say, a lot of the thought is that it's the wind that blows the leaves off, but not necessarily so. It's this change in the hormones within the plant, and that's what triggers the process of starting leaf drop. So the leaves are a way to produce sugars, and that feeds the plant. And so closing that down really sort of makes the tree a bit more robust. It preserves moisture within the tree. And the whole cycle of dropping the leaves gives a cleaning, clean up of the tree's sort of mechanism for making chlorophyll and making its sugars and developing. So it's kind of an interesting thing that's really what happens. And of course, the other byproduct is the beautiful sight of the different colours of the leaves slowly change and drop from the tree.
I think they've been really good this year, and I think trees are hanging on to them.
I think it's been such a changeable year. I think a lot of things have really probably been confused, a bit like the circadian rhythms.
Yeah.
You're used to cycles, you're used to temperatures, and they've been a bit wild. And I think that we're talking about the tree protecting moisture. Well, we've had quite a bit of moisture recently.
But we haven't earlier on in the year. I think a lot of trees are stressed. Some are dead. Some look dead and diseased.
Yeah, well, a bit like people, you know. Like you said, you get confused when you're not sort of regimented to your clock. And I guess the cycle of nature's got the same thing. The bees came out early this year and then seemed to disappear for a stint. I've not seen very many now. The wet weather's been around. And it's lots of sort of changes that you wonder, well, I do, and I just wondered, what's the clock mechanism for trees to start dropping leaves, and that's it.
It's to do with light levels, isn't it? Warmth, lights.
Well, I say it's actually internal. So that's what they're saying, is that the hormones change. In spring, the hormones there to promote growth, to put the leaf out and start this sort of engine that produces the food for the tree. And then in autumn, in preparation, that balance changes to another hormone, which starts this process of dropping the leaves. So it's an internal clock mechanism, I guess you could say. And it's not really tied to those sorts of ideas. But I think we've seen quite a lot of things like the real sort of windy weather that's been around damaging trees. And I'm not quite sure whether that they actually survive better at a certain time. I think when they're young, when the sort of early part of the cycle in spring, maybe they've got a bit more strength to bounce back, but they've also got a bit more flexibility because the tree's moisture is intact. So I just thought it was quite an interesting thing for autumn. And as I say, we'll look forward to the 30th of November when we'll plunge into
winter. We'll look forward to it. Well, it was incredibly warm on Thursday, 18 degrees where we were, and you just think, is this really October?
Yeah, it's the weather's been quite variable, hasn't it, this year? So I think it's very interesting. And there's been lots of sort of developments in scientific things around the world. So one of the things that caught my attention was Star Trek frogs.
Yeah.
researchers have discovered 7 new species of frogs in Madagascar. And the difference about these new species is, although you expect your frogs to be croaking, these 7 species tend to communicate with high-pitched whistling calls. And the researchers said that made sounds that were a bit like sound effects from Star Trek. So the noises reminded the research team led by Professor Miguel Vance of Technische Universität Braunschweig, Germany. He thought that reminded him of the science fiction show. So they've now named these frogs after characters from Star Trek. So you've got Kirk, Picard, Sisko, Janeway, Archer, Burnham and Pike. The Star Trek frogs that have just been discovered.
Very interesting. My word.
Yeah, that was good fun. And then they had a bear with a sore head in the UK. A brown bear underwent brain surgery, first operation of its kind in the UK. Seems to be recovering remarkably well, but Boki was a brown bear from the Wildwood Trust near Canterbury in Kent who had an MRI scan that revealed he'd got hydrocephalus.
Ooh.
And they operated on him to relieve the pressure build-up of the fluid around the brain, which is what hydrocephalus is. And this 2-year-old bear is said to be recovering well, but also he's not out of the woods yet, but he is taking his favourite medicine, which is Calpol.
Yeah.
Painkiller used for children.
Brilliant.
Containing paracetamol. So,
how did they know something was wrong with him then? Presumably he was behaving.
He's had a general MRI scan, I think, just on the health.
Oh,
side.
Just a general routine, but,
I say he was probably a bear with a sore head.
Oh, poor lad. Well, he will be if he's been on the Calpol.
Yes, very good. So his keeper said that still in the out of the woods. But he's amazed at how unfazed that he is by this operation and his treatment. It was performed by veterinary surgeon Romain Pizzi on the 9th of October. So the conservation charity said it's fundraising for his surgery and aftercare costs, which are expected to be about £20,000. So, good thing. And, we talked about artificial intelligence, and I said I've been getting interested.
Oh, you've got a book, haven't you?
Yeah, but this is not from the book. This is just a bit of general news. A lot of people may have seen a humanoid robot called Ada, A-I-D-A. And Ada talks and is sort of apparently robotic. She's got robotic arms, but she's got a very humanoid face. And she's been doing artwork as an artificial intelligence being. And some of her artwork was of Alan Turing, the father of computing in the UK, is often called. But her portrait's going to go to auction and is expected to make more than £100,000 to £150,000. They said in the article, which was in the iPaper that I read from Naomi Clark, that it was the first such artwork from an artificial intelligence. And I'm not sure about that because I think I have seen artwork. I mean, I've seen certainly robotic artworks gone up for auction. But whether it was created with artificial intelligence, I don't know. But Ada's first artwork, I mean, Ada comes from Ada Lovelace.
Ah.
That's why she got christened.
Is that Charles Babbage's assistant? Yeah. Oh, where did I get that from? Eh? Oh, eh? Because Charles Babbage, I knew, is the father of computing.
Yeah. Well, it's also in 2022, Ada painted portraits of acts headlining Glastonbury Festival. So she did portraits of Billie Eilish, Diana Ross, Kendrick Lamar, and Sir Paul McCartney.
What's that?
And she also did a painting of the Queen for the Platinum Jubilee and was the first robot to give evidence in a parliamentary committee discussing the impact of technology on creative industries.
It's quite a strange concept, I have to say. So what is the artwork like? Have you seen any, actually?
Yeah, there are a couple of pictures. It's a little bit like a photographic image, but it's also split into two different categories. So on one of her portraits, there's a whole sort of face made up with different shots of eyes. And on the Turing portrait, it's sort of half face and changing background. So one to look out for, but an amazing sort of price for some art from artificial intelligence.
Yeah.
Well, so the other thing that caught my eye was something, I guess, very close to home in Sheffield, is that researchers have shown that incinerating waste is as bad as using coal for something like the Bernard Road incinerator in Sheffield. It's burning household trash to create electricity, but also in Sheffield we use that as the inner city heating.
Heat and power, yeah.
Yeah.
It powers this building and I think the town hall.
Yep.
Town hall
uses both, but even so, they say that burning that waste is more damaging than people were expecting it to be. Almost half of the UK's household rubbish is now being burnt, incinerated, and a BBC study found that burning waste generates the same amount of greenhouse gas as coal power. So as usual, sort of cleft stick, I guess. Burning rubbish stops us, which the term ish that.
Thought we'd lost you there, Paul.
Yeah? I'm still with
you. You're back. I did see that article as well. I backed off because it was BBC research, and I think other people were saying it's not quite as simple. The calculations aren't quite as simple as they made out, but it's all to do with the fact that the last coal power station closed, isn't it?
Yes, I mean, I think it flows from that.
Yeah.
But, you know, I mean, I think that also you've got news that Google have signed up to use nuclear energy to power its artificial intelligence centres by 2030. So they've signed a deal with a small nuclear reactor producer. And they're going to use that to power artificial intelligence. So I think it's that sort of argument is we've got to come up with a balance.
Mm-hmm.
And again, in the news, there's the site where there's an array of batteries to store the energy that's produced from the sort of wind power and the sort of cleaner technologies. The problem with it is that they don't deliver throughout a 24-hour cycle. So something's got to fill the gap where we can't be tapping into those clean things. And one of the proposals, Rolls-Royce in the UK are developing small nuclear reactors to power localised supplies. So that's underway. I think the company that Google have signed up with is an American company based in California. And, you know, we've got the news that Amazon have just invested billions in the UK for creating data centres. So it is something that's directly relevant in the UK at the moment. And it's part of the mix. And again, one of the big arguments that's happening at the moment for the government on the energy sort of face is to carry the power from the wind generating fields to the places where it's needed. And there's a big argument at the moment for running pylons down the coast from somewhere near Hull, Goole, down through Norfolk, down to Suffolk, virtually a long run, where they're saying that they will have to use pylons. And of course, it's this long-running argument now of people not wanting the unsightly pylons running across their lovely countryside. But the reality factor is to bury the cables, or the alternative that they're saying there, because it's coastal, is to run a cable out into the sea, is a lot more expensive. So pylons are the cheapest and quickest way to create the power link, but it's one of those decisions that people will have to make, and that's across the country now, because of the position of the places where the wind generating systems are insufficient. If you're going to create you transfer it. And also, as I say, when the wind's not blowing, the sun's not shining on solar farms, then you need to store that energy. And we have talked in the past about different research. Some of it is using basically the power units that are taken out of electric vehicles. Beyond a certain point, they reduce the sort of radius that they can operate. So they take those cells out, the battery cells, and use them in either in storing domestic, so you have a bank of batteries in your home, store things from your solar power generation and wind power generation, so that you can utilise it overnight or when conditions don't prevail for producing power that way.
Indeed, it's difficult stuff. Paul, we're going to have to let you go there because we've got to get our Chris on.
Yeah, absolutely.
He's waiting in the wings. Brilliant.
I'm waiting as well. I like Chris's stuff, so I'll listen.
Excellent. We'll speak to you Monday, Glory Days Rock Show, 1 till 3.
Okay.
Bye-bye, Paul. Bye.
Bye.
Jason's there. What's the story? Morning Glory. RPG was bringing us up to date and lots of different things there. If you've just tuned in, you're of course listening to the Life Science Radio Show here on Sheffield Live 93.2 FM on digital if you're in South Yorkshire, or sheffieldlive.org, talking about science in all its different forms every week from 11 till 12. We've got Chris Dale on the line to talk about food allergies. Good morning, Chris.
Good morning, and a big happy birthday to Paul as
Oh, indeed, thank you. For the other day. Did you recognise that track, Chris? It's
Bug, I did, loved it, yeah.
Bugface, sir, fiery demon, attacks man, old man on bridge, brilliant. You're here to talk about food allergies yet again. Do you want to bring us up to date, or bring us...
Well, the last time that I spoke about food allergies was back in March, and we sort of spoke about the 14 allergens that have to be declared by law. I just wondered whether I should just run through those before we start.
Yes.
So there's celery and cereals containing gluten, such as wheat, barley and oats. There's crustaceans, which are things like prawns and lobsters. Eggs, fish, lupin, which is used in baked goods, pastries and pies. There's milk, mollusks, which are things like mussels and oysters. Mustard, peanuts, sesame, soya beans, sulfur dioxide and sulfites, which are often used as preservatives. And then there's tree nuts, which are things like almonds, hazelnuts, Brazil nuts, etc. But as you're probably aware, the issue of food allergies has been raised in the press recently following the tragic death of a young girl who had an allergic reaction to milk. Very sad that. And it made us sort of think about what's happening around the food allergy. So last time I spoke about food allergies, but this is now talking about the detail behind it. And the interesting thing is that it is believed that food allergies have doubled in the last 10 years. And it's a trend that's really puzzling scientists. And of course, it's disproportionately affecting young children. And that was the bit that was the big surprise to us. So what does the data show? A study published in the journal, and it was the Lancet Public Health, revealed that 4% of under fives have a probable food allergy in 2018. And that's up from 1.25% in 2008. That's nearly a 400% increase.
It's a big jump.
It is. Across all age groups, the prevalence of food allergies has increased a little bit. It's not a massive amount, but it's about a 1% rise over the same decade. So you can see how significant that is for the younger population. It also appears that the risk of having a severe allergic reaction has increased in recent years as well. And Professor Adam Fox, who's the chair of the National Strategy for Allergy, says that the prevalence of food allergies was rising and leading to an increase in severe reaction. The UK has one of the highest proportions of food allergies in the world. And he also said that most allergic reactions happen in the home, and then in schools, and then in restaurants.
Interesting.
Yeah, I mean, the one about schools, of course, if there's a rise in allergies amongst young people, they will then be going to schools. And, of course, you only find out if you have an allergy if you're exposed to it, don't you?
Yeah, you do. And sometimes you're not aware you're even allergic to something.
Absolutely. And I'm going to talk about that in a minute as well. So some of the theories are that the rise in these food allergies is they call it the hygiene hypothesis. And the idea in that the Western world, children are less exposed to germs, meaning the immune system does not properly develop and may overact to safe foods. Experts also believe that the change in the Western diet, gosh, haven't we spoken about that?
Oh, we have.
Including a shift towards ultra-processed food, and the timing of weaning babies on solid food may play a role in driving up allergies. And they also say, and this has been around a long time, that other factors, including the greater use of antibiotics in early life, may disrupt vital gut bacteria. But it's funny, isn't it, how everything has that ultra-processed food in it as we...
Yeah,
because you research further.
Yeah, because your body's not designed to process absolutely those chemicals. Yeah. So what can be done?
Well, there's an urgent need for better support for GPs and primary care staff to care for patients at the risk of severe food allergy. And there's a whole sort of group of families that have got together where they tragically have a member of their family killed by food allergies, have called for the government to appoint an allergy czar to tackle the epidemic. There is also calls for action to address the lack of life-saving adrenaline auto-injector pens or EpiPens being prescribed, particularly in deprived areas of the country and also in schools. And funnily enough, I was out with a very close friend of mine yesterday, and his son has got an allergy to peanuts. So his son's in his 20 now. But his son carries 2 EpiPens with him at all time because, I didn't know this, some of the EpiPens have proven to not be effective. So even if somebody gets an EpiPen, there is a chance they don't work because they haven't been manufactured properly.
Oh, my words. So has his son always had that peanut allergy, or has it just come about?
No, he's had it from about the age of 4, and that was when he ate peanuts and had a reaction and had to go to hospital. And do you remember when I was on in March, you said to me, how do you know if you've got a food allergy? Well, I asked him that question. He said, well, you're just going to be exposed to the allergy and then you find out.
Yeah, and hopefully you can get treatment quickly.
Yeah, absolutely.
Wow.
But going back to that terrible case of this young 13-year-old girl who had an allergic reaction. So Hannah Jacobs, she died within hours of sipping a drink bought by her mother. And they went to a well-known coffee takeaway. And her mum asked for 2 hot chocolates to be made with soya milk and not to use equipment that had been exposed to cow's milk. Now, under the coffee shop rules, customers who ask for non-dairy products should be shown a book that's kept under the till that shows how the ingredients, what ingredients are in there and how the drink is made. And the staff did not show the mum the book because the mum so confidently said, please can I have 2, made with, not with cow's milk and not using the equipment that's been exposed to cow's milk. They just assumed that the mum knew what she was doing. But when they left the coffee shop, they went to the dentist, and a short while she took her first sip of the drink, and Hannah just immediately knew that there was something not right and said, this is not complete soya milk. And she quickly got chest pains, but she took her to a nearby chemist to try and get an EpiPen, but it was too late, unfortunately. So it just happened incredibly quickly. The girl, Hannah, had never had such an acute allergic reaction before, so she didn't have her EpiPen with her.
Wow. So that had just come on. But the thing, that just shows that such a serious reaction that ends in death just from a wrong...
She knew she had an allergy to milk, but she'd never had... And she had had sort of mild symptoms, but never had such an intense one before.
Wow.
Which is just incredible. And then obviously we knew about the lady that died after eating a wrap that had been labeled vegan but contained dairy protein. Mum of 5, Celia Marsh, she collapsed when she was on a shopping trip with her husband and her 3 daughters, and she died after eating a super veg rainbow flatbread, and the sandwich had been labeled vegan. And she'd always avoided anything, anything to do with anything that was non-vegan, because she'd had a near fatal allergic reaction some months earlier. But the yogurt in the wrap was meant to be vegan, but subsequently found to contain traces of dairy protein. But she had her EpiPen with her, but unfortunately she collapsed before she could use it. And that just explains how incredibly quickly these things can happen.
Yeah, but it's just, it's what's quite surprising, if you don't have any food allergies, it's almost unbelievable, isn't it, that you know, having a yogurt that's got protein in it could end up with that situation.
Yeah, it's really bad, and there are examples of some form of egg being used as a preservative in things like cheap Parmesan cheese.
Ah, yeah.
And I've unfortunately, as you know, I have an egg allergy, yeah. And I've succumbed to that, not fully understanding what it meant on the labelling.
But you don't expect Parmesan cheese to have egg in it.
No.
But this is it, isn't it?
And this is where people try to make Parmesan cheese cheaper and for it to last longer, so it becomes ultra-processed. They start using preservatives in it. And again, you know, that causes problems for people.
Yeah. So,
but the other thing I was going to say was that people can develop or stop having allergies over time. It can work two ways. You know, you can develop allergies, as I've developed an egg allergy, but equally, you can lose your allergies as you get older. But it's very, very rare that allergies can also develop very quickly. And recently, a teacher, Elaine Fraser, she collapsed at home after drinking ginger beer. And she had absolutely no idea that she had a food allergy. And fortunately, she'd been trained at school to spot an anaphylactic shock. So she worked out what was happening and managed to contact somebody at the school to bring her an adrenaline pen that saved her life, which is, you know, fantastic. But doctors have been able to work out what was in the ginger beer that caused the allergic reaction.
Yeah, so, unbelievable. But you don't know. You know, we talk about, I think I spoke on the Science Show a few weeks back about examples where people had unknowingly consume something. They were so careful about avoiding certain things, but the labels were incorrect.
Yes, and that's why in recent times on some of the food labels, they now saying that they can't guarantee that there aren't anything in, because food is created in environments where nuts may be present or sesame may be present or dairy may be present or something like that. Which is really a cover-all. But, I mean, these examples that I've just given are absolutely tragic. And, of course, I mentioned earlier that, you know, most anaphylactic shocks happen in the home, then schools and in restaurants. And we've discussed this before, that restaurants do amazingly well, don't they, to cater for allergies.
They certainly do, yeah.
But often due to the size of the kitchens and the size of the business, things can go wrong, and quite often some of the people working in kitchens, you know, they might use a knife on something that contains nuts, they might not clean it properly and then use that knife on something else, and it, you know, it just puts people at risk, doesn't it?
It does.
Despite all the efforts that they do to try and sort of accommodate for people. And who knows, but, you know, the other thing I wanted to say was, you know, does ultra-processed food have an impact on developing allergies?
Yeah.
You spoke, didn't you, the other week about buying a plain ham sandwich?
Oh, well, tuna, mayo, and the list of ingredients on the back of the sandwich was as big as the sandwich box. And we just thought, it shouldn't really have all that in it, should it?
No, even a ham, you know, just a plain ham sandwich from a leading supermarket. I think it's got so many additives in it that you can't pronounce
chemicals.
Them, and surely that can't be good for you.
Yeah, exactly.
And then the other thing, of course, that was mentioned earlier was that how the diet is changing and how we're moving away from home-cooked food to processed food, and whether that has an impact on allergies as well in helping those allergies develop.
Yeah, I think over time the research will start to show. I mean, the government's already talking about having to look at banning junk food adverts after 9 o'clock at night. They're looking at that next year, but I think it needs to go a lot further than that.
Well, I think, Julie, that's all down to the Live Science radio show.
Well, I think it's down to you, Chris. You chose it as a topic, and it is a really important topic. And your mantra's been, if you can, prepare your own food. And if you can do a small change every week when you shop, just have a look at a label and change the product, make a small change. We've basically eradicated almost all traces of chemicals when we buy things from the supermarket.
And when I was speaking to that friend yesterday, whose son who had the peanut allergy, he said that in the last 20 odd years, he's never bought bread from a supermarket.
No.
He makes his own bread every other day because of the amount of additives that are in it. And obviously with his son having the allergies to sesame and peanuts and things like that, you have to be really, really careful about the things. So he's done exactly what you've said, and made those changes, but made them 20 odd years ago. So he never touches anything that is ultra processed because of his son's allergies.
Yeah, I think it's a good thing for everybody. It doesn't matter when you start. We started probably 6 months ago. You know, and we've made some big changes, and we've lost weight, feel better.
And we're still hungry.
And we're still hungry, Chris.
Yeah.
Now, don't worry about that. We're always hungry. But anyway, thanks so much for doing that, Chris. Fantastic stuff. Very topical. You are going to come back at some point and talk about tooth decay in children, because, again, that's linked to ultra-processed food, sugar in your diet, sweets, drinks.
And the marketing of supermarkets.
Indeed. The marketing of McDonald's, Kentucky Fried Chicken, blah, blah. They're all at it, aren't they? And they get away with it, whether the government will intervene eventually. Because it is
a big
health issue, isn't it?
It is.
And you may come back and talk about, you know, weight loss drugs, you know.
Come talk about those.
There's a lot to talk about, yeah, indeed.
There is, but I just want to say to people, prepare your own food if you can. Reduce the amount of ready meals and ultra-processed food and sugary drinks as much as possible.
Yeah.
And that's what we do, isn't it?
It is indeed. Fantastic stuff, Chris. We're going to play out with your chosen track. It's Alice Cooper, Poison.
Thank you so much.
Bye-bye, Chris.
Bye.
You're poison.